mic a little bit closer to where you are, because this is going to be like afterwards an internet broadcast. And we will have to ask when it gets until the conference over.
Well, tell me what questions you can ask.
Yeah, it's basically mostly about the period 1955 to 1965.
Long period.
Because I've talked to many people, I'm doing research on integration, and I had many lines in translation. I'm always pointing to the experiences with your words, and nearly all of them have asked across your path of empathy in that period. And I love the eyes, say, 1965. I feel like I need to have your perspective because these are their experiences and maybe one of the things that they say, and to talk to you about your own
care partner.
Okay.
And that's the time.
Yeah, I was just such a pleasure. Oh, I'm so much. How long did you expect this to be?
Well, I'm going to ask the questions that there are.
No time frame.
I don't have a time frame, but I think you have a time frame, so that's the time frame.
Yeah.
We have questions. We're en route back. En route.
But the questions are not so much about historical data and facts, but a little bit also more about approaches and
about what do?
Approaches and ideas and
from the dressing room to back to the hotel, please. To the suite. Pronto, right away.
Tell her I'm here if she wants
and
to call.
Anna's in her room. Yes, okay. Thank you.
You have to ask Anna because she's the one
what, dear?
Deciding here, I think.
What?
I'm going to just lie down for the night and sleep out.
Okay.
Wonderful. Just do that.
You should have to.
Does Sandra may ask?
Certainly.
Thank you. Okay. We're here in Paris. It's the 25th of September. I'm speaking to Anna Halperin, who's presenting older and recent pieces in Centre Beaubourg. And questions are basically dealing with the period of the San Francisco Dancers Workshop, and more precisely about the period 1955 till 1965. This term, or this word, workshop, comes from Bauhaus.
Comes from jazz as well.
Comes from jazz as well. I was just
Comes from American, it comes from not American Indians, but also comes from East Indians. The ragas are all improvised around particular themes.
Yeah.
Isn't that so?
Well, I was thinking of only the word, workshop,
Oh, the word workshop.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Comes from the Bauhaus.
Yeah.
I thought you meant improvisation.
No,
the word workshop definitely, for me, was inspired by the idea of the workshop and collaboration between different medias. Yes, absolutely.
You can be really credited for bringing that word into the dance field.
I think so. I do. I think so. Uh-huh.
And with the workshops these days being so abundantly there, it's maybe very important to reestablish how unique it was at that time to
come up with
a notion like this workshop.
Yes, yes.
Can you describe a little bit that?
As I understand it, the Bauhaus use of the word workshop was to point up an approach in which artists from different medias interacted and collaborated together so that they would come up with ideas that perhaps they wouldn't have come up to towards by themselves. For example, Oscar Schlemmer was, I mean, what would you call him? A dancer, an actor, a designer? You know, it was opening up the new frontiers of possibilities. And I was very intrigued with that idea. My husband was going to Harvard Architectural Department, where Gropius, who was director of the Bauhaus in Berlin, had fled the Nazis and became the architectural director of the Harvard Department of Architectural Design. So yes, that's a little bit of the history.
Yes. So there's this collaborative platform,
yes,
of encounter,
which it really appealed to me very much in terms of what I was searching for in my own search for new possibilities and ways to avoid the preconceived stylization of modern dance, in which so many of us, including myself, were becoming very poor imitations of very great people who had made a very great contribution, but somehow or other we were a pale imitation of something that had been at one time extremely important and significant. And I was searching for ways to find new roots.
Improvisation was an important means in your search?
Yes, indeed. Yes. But it wasn't as loose. It wasn't loose because I used improvisation for many different reasons. Basic to all was my search for the principles of nature in its operation. I've always been searching for how to objectify so that one could find their own unique expressive mind revealed through movement. And in order to do that, I felt that I had to understand the principles of nature, whether it was the nature of movement, whether it was the nature of how we interact, whether it was the nature of the context of the environment, whether it was urban or rural. So underlying always my search was how to find the nature of things. Now, improvisation I used not to discover the nature of movement. I went to, I did human dissection for a year to discover how the body works, and kinesiology and anatomy, and so that was fairly simple to understand. And I'm still learning more and more about how the body functions. But human relations was a little bit out of my realm in the late 50s. And so improvisation was a way for me to try to bypass the habitual responses or dependency on someone else to tell you what to do. So I began to work very much with, I'm going to tell you what to do, but not how to do it. So there was an underlying structure. And then it was a way to, well, how do people relate? What is the nature of relationships? And improvisation was a way to somehow or other liberate the mind from preconceptions. And that's how I began to use it. But then I began to see certain recurring principles that has to do with in relationships, that either you lead or you follow or you blend or you're somewhere in between, from say 1 to 10 being passive or 1 to 10 being active. So then it could become very precise. But I began to notice this repeating itself over and over. Somebody's leading, somebody's following. Sometimes two people want to lead at the same time. Sometimes two people are passive at the same time. Sometimes we blend. So I began to find certain principles repeating themselves over and over. But you could get very precise because you could either be so passive that you had, you were limp and you had to be dragged like a sit-down strike? Or two people could be so determined to be leaders at the same time that it could create a tremendous struggle? And so I could then refine the kinds of directions for structures. So we did a lot of that, and it was, I noticed, different when two people were working, or the numbers of people that were involved would shift the structure. So I was always an observer trying to understand what's the nature of our relationships. After, and then I also we had this password. I'm going to tell you what to do, but not how to do it. And that was very liberating for me to observe, not only in myself, but in others. Then I noticed that when you worked with relationships with great numbers of people, that there was a shift. And so I began to do improvisations with lay people, with non-dancers, as many as 100.
In that period that we
started in
about?
The 60s.
Yeah.
After started in the 60s. Then I would sit back and observe, what do communities do? What do animals do? If an animal is threatened and there's a flock, what do? They organize together. What did the pioneers do when they were attacked? They made a circle. And I began to notice that when large groups, 100 and over, begin to have an open structure, that there are repetitive archetypal ways that they have
of social organization.
They make circles. They make passageways. They make groups, one group, two groups, one person in relationship to a whole group, sort of like a heroic figure. And I just began to make notes. This is what groups do. And I would do it over and over again so I could see patterns repeated over. So this has a little bit to do with the nature of how communities interact. So for me, the word improvisation has many, many different, it responds to many, many different needs in many, many different human situations. I noticed that there were cultural differences. I noticed when I was doing the planetary dance, now this is moving up further into the 80s.
Yes.
I noticed that when I was doing the planetary dance, which is a very closed score, that the Japanese people organized very quickly. Very quickly they became one beat. They became one voice.
They know, they understand the collective body.
They understood a collective body instantly. American people that are so diverse in their cultural backgrounds, I mean, there are, you know, South American, Chicanos, Latinos, Asians, African Americans, Native Americans, the cultural differences. And you put them all together, it might take them an hour to come to a consensus, whereas the Japanese will come to a consensus within 3 minutes. So that was very interesting to notice. And to give it its due. If that's the truth of the situation, that's what it is. That is the nature. Diversity is important in acknowledging our differences and give it its dues. But there is a moment when humans as community need to find their commonalities as well. So these are all ways that, for me, that I have of working with the different levels of what's called improvisation. At about the 80s, I began to find a need to work with a visible approach to generating creativity. And that's when my husband was such a great help. And together we worked out a system, a method called collective creativity. And we found that in the process of creativity, there are four major separate independent activities, actions. And one of them is, and they can go in any order whatsoever they can go. The circle can go around one direction, or it could go around another direction, or it could crisscross, but there are four specific things that are needed for any kind of creation of any kind of a product. Whether it's performance, whether it's solving a conflict situation, it doesn't matter. One is collecting resources without any judgment. Just resources. We have an idea. Well, everybody collects resources. You don't make any judgments about whether that's good or bad. Then there's the process of making a score. How do you make a plan out of those seemingly random resources? Now, a very good way of collecting resources for dancers is to go right from resources to performing without a score. Just, here's some resources. Come in the room and come into the space and improvise with those resources. That will generate more resources. Okay, but it for me it's only useful to use improvisation that way to collect resources. In terms of performance, I would not do that anymore. I did at the beginning because it was fresh, but I began to see that it became very indulgent, and people kept repeating the same things, and it was not interesting except for them. It wasn't interesting for me anymore. It's like, all right, already I've seen that 100 times, so what? And it felt very indulgent to me, personally, and then maybe not for anybody else. But for me, it was becoming not interesting. It was not meaningful.
And that's how you move to more structured improvisation and score.
I don't even call it. To me, an improvisation is when you go from resources to performance, in order to expand your possibilities of resources.
Mm-hmm. You never seen it as a compositional tool?
No. Scores are. Because in a score, you have a basis for criteria. For collecting resources, there's no judgment involved. It's just, okay, anything goes, let's just see what happens. Okay, now when you make a score and you have an intention, this is what we want to accomplish, then you need activities, over time, in space, with people. And if you can define those four elements, you have a score that you can perform. And then you can perform it and say, what worked, what didn't work? You literally perform that score without any judgment, without any evaluation. It's perform that score. Now, you can evaluate it. There are two levels to that evaluation. First of all, did I perform the score or did I change it? If you changed it, then we have no basis to evaluate whether the score worked or not because you changed it. So then you evaluate, look, let's do it again so we can see whether the score's working. Okay, is the score... Now we can see, did the score work or didn't it work? What did you like about it? What didn't you like about it? But I always keep judgment out of anything. It's okay, this didn't work, or this did work, or let's add this resource, let's take that one out, let's do it again. But it's never, this was wrong, and that was right, and this was that bad, and this was good, and this didn't look good. I hate judgment. It just totally freezes me. So, and it freezes the performer.
The score is also a way to objectify a little bit
objective. Now, scoring is a very precise method. Because you can do very close scores, like the planetary dance that's being done in 36 different countries. It is very closed on one level. It's, you run in a circle. When one side of your body gets tired of running, you run the other way. If you are injured or old and you don't want to run, you can just do a little trot in the center circle. If you're a teenager and you just want to just run with all your might, you run in the outer circle. So over time, people have found personal needs, and so the score is beginning to become more developed in response to people's needs. If you're on crutches and you want to be in the planetary dance, you could stand in any one of the four directions and just feel the pulse and breathe with us. What's open about that score? The activity is closed, the space is determined, the time is open. When we did it in Germany, they kept it going. They were so determined. They kept it going for an hour. When we do it in Marin County, we stop. We share our experience. We start it again. We do it for the children. We do it for pregnant women. We do it for the men. We do it for the women. We have found through. Now, this is our 25th year of doing it every year on the mountain. Every year we do it, we find another way of adding to the score. But the most important thing that is open in that score is when you start, you say, I run for. You always run for others. You never run for yourself. And at that point, the intentionality becomes more important than the form. I remember.
It reveals that as well.
Yeah. Because the score allows for that, for the meaning, the ritualistic aspect to come forward. I remember I was watching, and this one man, oh, he had so much spirit in his face and in his body. And afterwards, he came up to me and he said, I ran for my twin brother, John, who had been murdered 10 years ago, and I have never uttered his name in 10 years. He said, today was the first time I called John. I just, you know, I thought, this is just an ordinary person. He's not a dancer. He's never done anything like, he's from Ghana, he was visiting. And so the score was very closed, but on the other hand, it was very open. So scoring can be so precise. You can have one element open and other elements closed. So the openness and the closedness of a score is the skill for being able to meet the demands of its intention. So it's very precise, but it's also, if you see parades and changes where they do the dressing and undressing, it's a very close score. You dress and you undress and you do it 3 times. But how you do it is your choice. So there are always choices. Now, is that improvisation? No, not to me, that's not improvisation. That's following a score. making choices becomes another way of saying, well, for some people that's called improvisation, but for me it's not. Improvisation is when you go from resources to performance and there's no score. So I use the word improvisation, but in those 30 years I've been fine-tuning it and altering it so it becomes a little more precise, and particularly so there's opportunity to have a criteria.
For example, to give a concrete example, how would you, for example, then relate to a performance by Steve Paxton,
which is instant
composing?
I don't like to talk about other artists.
Okay.
I can talk about myself and what's real for me.
But just to see if...
I don't even know. I worked with Steve one time, and we worked together maybe 10 years ago, and... we started out doing contact improvisation, as I understand it, and then I switched and added resistance, and he went with it. I don't know. I really don't like to...
I understand.
I don't... I can only talk about what my experience is.
There's an article that you wrote on improvisation that was published in 1969. It's called Intuition and Improvisation. It's a very insightful text. I want to ask a question about... you speak sometimes in that text, but also in other contexts, of authenticity in movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if there's such a thing as false movement.
As what?
False. Or what is authenticity?
Well, I define it now.
Yeah.
Because now it can be confusing because of the precise definition of authentic movement by Adler.
I'm not speaking about authentic movement, but more your use of the word.
Yeah, I don't use it anymore because of that.
Okay.
I'm always going back to my aesthetics are based on the principle of how nature operates. That's all I'm interested in, is understanding more and more, whether it's human nature, whether it's our interactions with the natural environment. I did a movie called Returning Home, and there I am exploring what is my connection to the natural world. What's my connection to a tree, to mud, to animals? And this, you know, I'm approaching the end of my life. And as I approach the end of my life, I am more and more interested in the expansion of self to others and to the world around me. And so it's that time in my life when I'm interested in the return to nature in its largest form. And I feel that the more, I see it like a pebble, and you drop a pebble into a pond and it starts concentric circles, expanding and expanding and expanding and expanding. And to me, the more one can incorporate an awareness of the world that we live in, the more spiritual one can connect. So, let's see. So that's where my aesthetics derive from, is the search for what is the nature of things, and how do we fit into the largest scheme of things. And I'm learning all the time.
Is placing yourself in an art context or an art historical context or in relation to other artists of importance to you? If I'm So I understand your strongest attachment is to nature and issues you just mentioned.
I feel that one of the most important things that I've learned from my illness when I was stricken with cancer was how important being whole is, that the body cannot be a physical instrument. It is physical, it is emotional, it is that we think through images, that we are a holistic organism, and that this holism includes our relationship to others, our relationship to family, our relationship to community, and our relationship to the environmental context in which we live. And that is a whole, that is holistic. And if any one of those things are missing, you're missing a link. Now, what I respond to aesthetically in art is when I feel that the artist is in some way holistically connected. And then I can feel myself being touched and moved and fascinated or challenged. Sometimes I'm challenged by the skill that somebody has developed in their ability to be a holistic performer. Sometimes I'm challenged by something I never would have, that I had never in my own experience thought of a possibility. Sometimes I'm tremendously touched by indigenous cultures and the way in which dance and the arts have maintained their cultural identity and have connected them to the spirit world. Sometimes I'm touched by a child just being just gleefully engrossed in stomping in the puddle after a heavy rain. Sometimes I'm touched by an older person just being able, especially when I worked with people with life-threatening illness, and sometimes I'm just enormously touched by their ability to express their connection to life through maybe all they can move is their hands. I can find aesthetic inspiration in so many different ways. It's not what I see always in a museum or on a concert stage, or it's what I see in life that touches me.
I would conclude with a couple of questions on parades and changes, since we've seen it just very, very recently,
yes,
and it's fresh in the memory. And I was wondering around the dressing and undressing, as we saw it in the piece, would you call that task-oriented movement?
No. I don't like that. That's not, I mean, I use that expression one day in class, just do a task, carry a log from here to there. But that, it wasn't a task that was important. It was, did you feel the weight? Try carrying that faster. Try carrying it slower. Try carrying a person. Try carrying two people. The idea of labeling things has never really, I feel that boxes you in. I just use that expression to get them to appreciate ordinary movement and to be able to understand. Okay, so if you're going to take your shirt off and you take it up over your head, are you in touch with the lift? And how is that different than when you put it down? What is the difference in quality and feeling state and imagery? The task by itself is just an entrance way into the body to find its expression.
Mm-hmm.
I don't use that. Other people do. But that was just, nothing more than a way to enter the body in a non preconceived stylistic form.
The slow motion, was that also in the original version, yeah, in 1965? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Always.
Because that's a strong element.
I wanted
of stylization.
It to, when I first introduced nudity, nobody had used nudity, and I wanted it to have a sense of reverence and ceremony, so I wanted it to be very slow. And that was my way of creating that sense of reverence.
The moment where they are walking around and choosing someone in the group that they're going to follow for a while and then choosing someone else, this has been one of the improvisation exercises that I've seen later in many workshops. I was wondering if it stems from your practice then in the 60s or...
Yeah. Well, walking is very immediate, isn't it? It's something we can all do, and it incorporates so many possibilities in terms of how you can feel the pulse, how you can work with direction, how you can deal with force and dynamics. So it's a very accessible movement. That's why I chose it.
Maybe last question, more not necessarily in immediate connection, in immediate connection to parades and changes, but more in general. What is the role of sexuality in your work?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. I love it. It's part of life. That's all. It's just as simple as that. It's part of life. I consider the use of nudity in parades and changes as being more sensual than sexual. And I make a great distinction between sensuality and sexuality. And I consider it to be more sensual.
Yes, yes, I agree.
But I don't know how it reads. Obviously, it was in the beginning, when I first introduced it, it obviously was considered sexual, otherwise I wouldn't have been arrested. But that was not my intention, and that certainly was not the imagery that the dancers were working with. But that's what the public brought to it, because that was their association. And I must say, I was very naive. I was extremely naive and kind of single-minded and sort of stupid in a way, not to have understood that. But my studio is an outdoor deck, and there are no walls. There's no, and so it's very sensual. We even used to dance in the rain and feel the sensuality of the water on the body, or the sun, or the wind. So it was really very naive. But it's very different now. I feel I've only performed that dance a few times, because I did, since it first came out in 1965 and I was arrested, I didn't perform publicly for another 10 years, because that's any time people would say, oh, she's going to take clothes off, we can't have that. I just forget it. I just didn't perform. But I didn't start doing parades and changes again until 2 years ago. This is only the fourth time we've ever performed it. Isn't that silly?
Well, it's never too late. Thank you very much. And thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.